Welcome to Animal Airwaves Live here on WUFT-FM. This is our weekly hour-long show devoted to the discussion of the health and welfare of animals. I'm Dana Hill, and I'm very happy to welcome back to the program today our friend from the University of Florida College of Veterinary Medicine, Dr. Wyndham Mendizi. We're going to be talking today about preventing disaster. Now, that means preventative care that can save you a lot of money and certainly your pet maybe a lot of agony. Things like vaccinations, things like heartworm prevention, maybe even keeping your pet trim and fit can help save you money and keep your pet nice and comfortable in the long term. Animal Airwaves Live will be back after this news from NPR. Welcome to Animal Airwaves Live here on WUFT-FM. This is our weekly hour-long show devoted to the discussion of the health and welfare of animals. I'm Dana Hill, and I'm very happy to welcome back to the program today from the University of Florida College of Veterinary Medicine, our good friend, Dr. Wyndham Mendizi. And we're going to be talking today about preventing disaster. That is to say, ways that you can prevent very expensive treatments by maybe taking a few precautionary steps for your pet. And welcome back to the program, Dr. Mendizi. So glad you could be here.
Thank you very much. It's good to be back.
So when you are in your day-to-day job treating animals maybe for dental problems or giving vaccines or maybe taking care of some sick pets, you probably recommend to your human clients that they maybe take preventative steps with the pets to help prevent some diseases down the road that might cause great expense. But I bet you often see animals that are coming in with an ailment or malady of some sort that is going to cost a pretty decent amount of money to take care of, and that disease might have been prevented, or that visit even might have been prevented with just a few precautionary steps?
Sure, yeah. So, I mean, as a veterinarian, one of the most heartbreaking things we see lots of different types of emergencies day in and day out. And but one of the things that, you know, of course, gets to us the most is something that's maybe that we're not able to treat due to just financial limitations of the owner, but it's something that could have been very, very preventable. So that's always a heartbreaking scenario. We see a lot of things that, of course, can't be prevented, and but the things that we can actually prevent, that we actually have early detection for and early treatment for, you know, those are the most heartbreaking when we might even encounter the end of the life of that animal due to financial limitations.
Well, there's probably many of these different conditions, so let's kind of start with maybe some of the more common ones.
Sure, yeah. So, I mean, the one I think everybody would think about, you know, first off would be, you know, just basic vaccinations. I mean, so when we see a new puppy, when we see a new kitten, we automatically have a series of vaccinations that we recommend. And so just for one example, parvo in dogs is something that's extremely preventable. It's very commonly seen in young puppies or even puppies up to, say, 6 months old. Any age dog can get parvo, but we see it much more often in younger dogs. The cost for the vaccination is, you know, only about $25. Of course, you're going to be factoring this in with other vaccinations and your visit and things. But, you know, just for a new puppy, you know, visit, you just say, just depending on your clinic, you might be looking at anywhere from, you know, $50, $75 up to maybe $150, $200. You know, versus the treatment for a puppy with parvo, I mean, you're looking at, you know, over $1,000 usually, depending on how severe the infection is and whether it can be treated, you know, inpatient or outpatient. Most parvo puppies usually do have to be hospitalized, and often that might lead to the euthanasia of that puppy just for financial limitations. And even if you know, owners are able to spend that type of money on hospitalizing their puppy, I mean, a large number of these puppies die anyway. Even no matter what we do, we still see a lot of fatality with that.
Let's talk a bit about what parvo is exactly, because it sounds pretty frightening if in a number of cases it is this expensive to treat.
Sure, yeah. So parvo is a viral infection seen, again, usually in very young dogs. And so it is just a virus, but it affects the intestinal tract. And so what we see is lots of really, really bad bloody vomit, bloody diarrhea in these puppies, and they get extremely dehydrated. And usually they develop nasty secondary infections, can become septic, and usually are very, very sick. Terrible vomiting, terrible diarrhea. And again, it's just a virus that's actually very preventable with a vaccine.
How do they catch it?
They actually get it from other dogs, so it's very, very communicable. Puppies that we have that have parvo in the hospital, they are in an isolation ward with strict isolation protocol because it is something that's very communicable from either their mother or from other puppies or from other dogs that they encounter.
Is it likely that, and I hate to even use the word likely, but is it sometimes seen that animals that maybe come from breeders or shelter environments or some place like that have maybe been exposed to dogs that have this condition?
I mean, sure. Anytime you're in a situation where there's lots of dogs around, and whether that's a shelter environment or, you know, a breeder or from, you know, just puppies being around other puppies, anytime you're around, you know, there's a lot of different dogs around, then you have you increase your chance of communicable disease.
Puppies have it more than adult dogs?
Yes, adult dogs. Most adult dogs that we see, of course, have been vaccinated for it. And it is part of vaccination protocol after their puppy series and then their first year puppy vaccine that it does include a parvo vaccine as well as others like distemper. Then it's an every 3 year vaccine. But adult dogs tend to have quite a bit of immunity to it. So we do see it much more in young dogs that have usually not been vaccinated.
So it's an every 3 year vaccine. You probably want to see a pet like a dog every year.
Yes.
So does a pet owner need to tell you how frequently this pet has been vaccinated?
Oh, no. Well, because yes, definitely that's something we would want to know. If we've never seen that patient before, we would want to know what their vaccination history is. If they've been regularly vaccinated, then again, it's an every 3 year vaccine. But keep in mind, this is one vaccine, you know, amid lots of vaccines that are recommended. And so, for example, you know, rabies is an every 3 year vaccine as well. But other types of communicable disease like Bordetella, which is kennel cough in dogs, or leptospirosis, which is a bacterial infection in dogs, those are recommended yearly vaccines. And, of course, we do recommend yearly exams, regardless of whether or not your pet is due for vaccines or not. And that's another point to make as far as preventative care, because there's plenty of things we find on just yearly exams. For example, maybe just a small, you know, skin tumor that the owner may not even think is a really big deal, but it turns out to be a malignancy. And there's some, of course, red flags that we would look for with regard to that, questions that we would ask the owner about the size. Does it, you know, get bigger and smaller, things like that. And, you know, obviously that's something that's going to definitely need to come off. Whereas if they came in a year later or 2 years later and this mass has really grown or even may still be the same size on the skin but has spread to other organs, then, of course, we're talking about a much more expensive and much more deadly disease then.
Right. These tumors, we can probably talk about those a little bit later because they're something that could be almost totally benign, but could be something more serious. And that's just
sure.
About figuring out which is which. But let's sort of move down the line. We've got parvo is one that's seen a lot. Mm-hmm. What else is seen a lot?
Well, I mean, again, if we're talking still about communicable disease, you know, distemper, obviously, I mean, for a puppy, again, that's something that's very preventable. It's another viral infection. It affects the respiratory tract, digestive tract, and dogs can become neurologic that have distemper. So in about 50% of cases, those cases are fatal. And again, this is something that's very preventable. Hospitalization, usually these dogs have pneumonia. And so hospitalization, again, they have to be, you know, housed in an isolation unit while they're hospitalized, which definitely adds to the expense. And we are still talking about, you know, getting up definitely over 500, probably in the thousands, to hospitalize and treat a distemper dog with, again, about a 50% chance of survival.
That's frightening odds, especially if you're a pet owner. You wouldn't want to hear that it's just a 50-50 chance that your pet is going to make it, particularly with, and not to sound so mercenary, but particularly when with our pets, money isn't always a no object kind of
sure.
situation.
In fact, often it's not. I mean, often it's not. We all, you know, most people have limited finances. And, you know, when you're looking at the cost of hospitalization and treatment, you know, when you're weighing that against the odds of it being a successful treatment, no matter what you do, you really do have to consider that. And you know, dogs and cats are euthanized for that reason. And again, when that's heartbreaking for us is that these were things that were very, very preventable. And not always. I mean, it's not to say that no animal that has received vaccines has ever gotten these diseases, but you're really, really, you know, warding it off by vaccinating your pet.
But distemper is another highly communicable disease?
It is, yes.
It's caught from other animals?
It is, yes.
How? Do they just, are in the same environment? Does it spread through fluid exchange or something?
Fluid exchange, and distemper can actually be spread, you know, it's aerosolized and can actually be spread. And there was actually a terrible outbreak at our local shelters. I think it was probably about 7 years ago or so, seven years ago. And we had a lot of dogs in Alachua County that came down with distemper. So, yeah, it's very communicable.
Well, with that disease like distemper, you say that there are neurologic signs. Mm-hmm. Tell us what some of that looks like.
So, I mean, usually what we see with distemper is the first signs are going to be either gastrointestinal signs like vomiting and diarrhea, or often we'll see, like I mentioned before, pneumonia, and dogs have to be hospitalized and treated for the pneumonia. And then anywhere from weeks to months later, dogs can then develop secondary neurologic signs. And that can be anywhere from seizure activity, which is usually what you'll see is seizure activity. I actually had a patient that I had actually adopted myself because the owner could not afford treatment, and I adopted him myself. And he actually lived through the pneumonia part of the treatment, and then actually became this, you know, formerly very, very sweet puppy, became extremely aggressive to the point of attacking the cage door. And that was his neurologic manifestation of the disease, and unfortunately he had to be euthanized because once they develop severe neurologic signs, there really isn't a whole lot you can do at that point.
So these dogs basically become not themselves anymore.
Right, yeah. And so that can be, I mean, with this puppy it was behavioral, which actually isn't, you know, the most common neurologic signs we see. Usually it's going to be more seizure activity, but again, it can be very severe and refractory to treatment, and again, usually ends up in the euthanasia of the pet.
And this is something that is preventable with a simple vaccine?
Yes.
And this vaccine is administered how often again?
As puppies, we do it every two. We usually start seeing puppies come in for their vaccines, and again, kittens as well, every starting at about 8 weeks of age. And we vaccinate them every 2 to 4 weeks until they're 16 weeks of age to just really boost their immunity. At 16 weeks, 1 year later, then they come back in for their boosters. And then after that, again, it depends on what vaccine we're talking about. But for distemper and parvo, after year one, then it's every 3 years after that.
What if you adopt a dog or a cat that you didn't get as a puppy or a kitten, and you don't really know what this animal's history is vis-a-vis vaccinations and mm-hmm. early sort of treatment? What if that animal didn't get the vaccines in sort of more frequent basis mm-hmm. as a very small animal?
So the good news is that by the time they've made it to adulthood, if they haven't gotten these diseases, they've got some automatic immunity just because they're older. They're not as susceptible to these diseases if they're healthy otherwise. And so we will go ahead and, of course, vaccinate those animals. And if they have no vaccine history at all, we will go ahead and do a booster at 2 to 4 weeks. And again, we're talking about distemper and parvo vaccine right now. And then a year later, so just again, just sort of like a puppy, but we don't do it every 2 to 4 weeks. We only do one and then a booster 2 to 4 weeks later. And then after that, next year, and then every 3 years after that. For rabies, the it's a little bit different. We give dogs a rabies vaccine at 4 months of age, cats too, at 4 months of age, and then yearly after that. Again, with dogs, we often do a three-year vaccine. With cats, we have an option of either a one-year or a three-year vaccine after year one.
Why would someone not choose the three-year vaccine?
Well, that's a really good question. Cats are actually very prone. I don't want to say very prone. It's actually still fairly uncommon, but they are prone to something called vaccine-associated fibrosarcoma, and it's actually a malignant tumor that forms at the site of vaccinations. There's some debate about what causes those tumors, but there seems to be a close link between vaccine adjuvant, which is something that's added to a vaccination to make it a little stronger, and the tumors. And so we have a one-year option in cats that's a non-adjuvanted vaccine. But without that vaccine adjuvant, it doesn't last for 3 years. We have to still administer it yearly, but a lot of studies have shown they're less likely to develop a sarcoma at the site of their vaccination if only a one-year vaccine is used. And that's why we don't have a one-year option in dogs, because dogs don't tend to get this problem.
Ah, okay. But that said, you're not looking necessarily at a huge expense if you get this vaccine for your cat every year versus once every 3 years. I mean, maybe you're saving $40, $50, I don't know.
Right, yeah. I mean, it's actually the cost is of the vaccine is the same, but of course you're paying for the vaccine, you know, 3 years in a row versus once every 3 years. But they actually did just they're just brand new right now coming out with a non-adjuvanted 3-year vaccine that we at the University of Florida, we don't carry that vaccine yet. We probably will. The cost of that vaccine, even for us to buy, will make the vaccine about 3 times more expensive. Mm-hmm. But again, the cost equals out in the long run because you are still doing it every 3 years.
Okay. Now, rabies, when we talk about this being a disaster, mm-hmm. is a huge disaster. I mean, that's as disaster as it gets, yes, in terms of your pet contracting this.
Yes. And not only from that standpoint, rabies is invariably fatal. And so, you know, if your pet does have rabies, he will either die from it or usually, if it's detected, be euthanized. But, you know, what's even worse is, of course, the just that this is communicable to humans.
Yes.
So, you know, anyone that's come in contact with that animal, you know, must then go through their own prophylactic treatment and vaccinations. And so that can definitely be, you know, kind of a nightmare if you come in contact with an animal with rabies.
Well, doesn't the state consider it a kind of public health issue?
Sure, absolutely. Yes. Yeah. And that's why there's you know, a lot of legality to rabies vaccinations. Most of our pets are not really, you know, versus parvo, which we talked about before being, you know, super contagious. I mean, rabies, they really have to be bitten by a rabid animal. So if you've got this, you know, little dog that really never leaves the house, the chance of getting rabies is very, very slim. But of course, it's a legal requirement for that dog to have rabies. A rabies vaccine.
I'll point out a very funny photo in headline in The Onion, the satirical newspaper, and it shows an adorable kitty just sitting politely on a sofa cushion. And the caption with the photo, there's no real accompanying story. It just is a caption that says, "Cat that spends entire life on one of two couches given rabies vaccine."
Right, right.
And yes. This points out that, like, this animal is really probably at very low risk of coming into contact with some—
A raccoon or a bat or something, right? Right, right, exactly.
But nevertheless, it is something that is required by law.
Yes.
And is something that, if it comes down to it, if your dog or your cat gets out of the house, this could, you know, I mean,
sure.
I've seen in my yard many times raccoons.
Mm-hmm.
I can't say that I've necessarily seen bats hanging out in my yard.
Right.
But bats do come around. We know that possums are really not great distributors of rabies, correct?
Right. Right.
So possums you probably don't have to worry about as much, but raccoons for sure.
Raccoons for sure, and bats definitely.
And
skunks.
Okay.
Yeah.
And I hope I don't have those in my yard. But raccoons and your pet are not a great combination when put
right.
together in the same place.
Well, and especially if you have an animal that is, whether it's a dog or cat, that's unvaccinated for rabies. And a lot of people don't realize this, but if you say your dog gets in a fight with that raccoon, it might get a couple of puncture wounds or a couple of bites. If your dog is vaccinated, then you booster that rabies vaccine, and then the dog is quarantined, but for about 3 weeks, and it can even be in your own home. If the dog or cat is unvaccinated, then by law, that animal has to be quarantined for a 6-month period at a state-approved facility, and you have to pay for it.
Wow.
And a lot of people don't realize that. It's another reason that's so important, you know, to have the vaccine done. Again, not because we really, you know, some of these animals really don't have a lifestyle that make us think they're going to get rabies. But if, like you said, they do sneak out of the house and they get in a fight with a raccoon going through the garbage can or something like that, if they do get bitten by that animal, then and there's, you know, that's the law. The other option is euthanasia. So euthanasia or a 6-month quarantine in a state-approved facility.
And a 6-month quarantine in a state-approved facility is probably not a huge bargain.
No. You're looking at a lot of money. I mean, depending on where it is, you know, it may be different if it's animal control versus if you choose to do it at your veterinary office. But yeah, you'd be paying for 6 months of boarding.
Well, this is going to put you as the veterinarian in a kind of unpleasant situation with the pet owner, because let us say that Moggy, who is never allowed outside under any circumstances except for to go to the veterinarian,
right?
But let us say that my wife opens the door, I open the door, and for some reason she bolts. Now, I don't think that she would do this because she's kind of terrified of whatever is outside. But were she to get outside and to have an encounter with a wild animal, and I brought her in to you and said she was bitten by a raccoon, I think.
Right.
You would look at her and you would say, Well, now, Maggie is vaccinated, so yeah. This is maybe not the best example. But were she not, you would then have to tell me, I'm really sorry, but we don't know if you're – cat now has rabies, but this is what has to happen.
Right. And we are required to report that. So, you know, we don't take care of it from there. It's actually animal control that would take care of it from there. But we would have to – legally, we would have to report that because it was an animal that bit another animal. And again, if the animal's vaccinated, then it's a lot more cut and dry. You can just go ahead and booster the vaccine. You still, you know, report the bite, but the animal, you know, stays in quarantine even in your home for 3 weeks. Versus an unvaccinated animal where the rules are just very different.
Yeah. So that is a kind of disaster that is an extreme disaster that, again, is essentially preventable. I mean, that is to say that your animal will most likely survive any sort of encounter with a rabid animal if it has the rabies vaccine.
Right.
Okay, so the pet is quarantined in your house for 3 weeks. That's no big deal. My cat is quarantined in my house forever.
All the time.
All the time. So, okay, so that's another big area. And again, that's one of the vaccinations that you take your pet in for its annual exam and you got to get the rabies vaccine.
Right. And again, I mean, there's certain health conditions that are going to prohibit animals from being vaccinated, autoimmune disease, things like that, where it's not in the animal's, you know, best interest to do vaccines. Vaccines aren't, you know, automatically just a benign thing. It is a medical procedure that you know, needs thought and an examination to go along with that. But yeah, I mean, it is something that we do recommend in otherwise healthy animals, the ones that don't have any reason to not be vaccinated. A healthy animal, otherwise, really, there's no reason, you know, shouldn't be able to get vaccines.
What about some of the conditions that can come from parasites that vaccines can help you ward off some of the ill effects?
So unfortunately, we don't really have any vaccines to prevent against parasites, but we do have monthly prevention. So most people that own dogs and even cats, you know, give their dog monthly heartworm prevention. And again, you know, cats as well. A lot of times in cats, it's a topical. In dogs, often it's an oral, but topicals and orals are available for both dogs and cats. But usually those are preventing against heartworms, which of course are a parasite, and also intestinal parasites like hookworms and roundworms, and maybe whipworms depending on your product. So these are very important things. I mean, we see animals that die from just hookworm infestation because they actually will become so anemic, you know, from losing blood from their digestive tract from the hookworms being embedded there. So I've seen dogs that have needed blood transfusions and cats that have needed blood transfusions just from nothing but hookworms. The good news about hookworms and roundworms is they're a little easier to treat. You know, you can just use an oral medication. Heartworms are a completely different story, and I know I've talked about heartworms on another episode of this show, but heartworms are very easy to prevent with a monthly preventative. To treat requires 2 months of strict cage rest and 2 injections of a medication to kill the adult heartworm. There's only one medication out there that's approved to kill the adult heartworm. It's a deep intramuscular injection. It can often be painful, can sometimes have side effects. And that's 2 months of strict cage rest during that treatment. So unfortunately, it's not like some of these other parasites where we can just give them an oral medication to treat. With heartworms, it's a really big deal. And a lot of people don't know that until it's too late. And then it's expensive, too. I mean, usually depending on the size of the dog, you're looking at between $500 and $1,000 to treat heartworms in a dog.
$500 to $1,000 to treat heartworms when an oral or topical medication costs really a small fraction of that.
Yeah, again, depending on the product, there's lots of different products out there. Some include medications that will kill fleas, you know, so we've got other things added in. But if you just used, you know, straightforward, say, for example, HeartGuard, which is gonna take care of heartworms plus intestinal parasites, hookworms and roundworms. I mean, and again, it depends on the size of the dog, but even in the very biggest dog, you're still looking at about maybe $40 to $50 for a 6-month supply.
A 6-month supply?
Yes. Yeah.
I mean, that's really pretty affordable for a lot of people who'd be listening to the program. And it does prevent a problem that could become very uncomfortable, to say the least, but also really dangerous.
Yes, very dangerous.
Right? Now, fleas don't generally present a kind of life-threatening danger in most cases.
Well, I mean, you know, you think that because we see them more as just sort of an inconvenience and causing our dogs to itch. I mean, we see a lot of flea allergy in dogs, which can be kind of expensive to control and require steroids and things like that. We see a lot of that in Florida. But fleas also carry other diseases as well. They carry blood parasites and things like that that can absolutely be life-threatening. And we can, especially in smaller animals, we can actually see anemia. Animals that have so many fleas that they are dangerously, life-threateningly anemic and require, again, blood transfusions just because of the amount of fleas that are on the animals, especially smaller animals. But, I mean, I saw once, you know, 60-pound dog that had hookworms and fleas and, you know, had a hematocrit of, you know, 9%. And it was just caused by those parasites. So we think of them as not real, fleas and ticks as not really causing that big a deal other than an inconvenience, and they're just kind of gross. But really, they can carry life-threatening diseases.
So 2 months of strict cage rest and basically treatment that can cost you hundreds of dollars for dogs. But the options are not so great for cats that come down with a condition like heartworms.
Right. So there actually are no options for cats that get heartworms. There is no acceptable adulticide treatment. So if your cats only get heartworms, one cat for about every 10 dogs. So the cats are kind of unique in that they can seem to fight off the heartworm infection. They can kill off the baby heartworms or the microfilaria. But the unfortunate thing is that if they do get adult heartworms, there isn't anything that we can do. And so they'll either clear it on their own or they will die from it. And we do see cats that die from heartworm disease. And short of, you know, trying to surgically go in and remove these heartworms, which obviously is extremely risky and a kind of an end-stage life-saving event, which, you know, again, often just isn't even successful, there really isn't anything you can do about your cat having heartworms. The adulticide that we use in dogs is fatal to cats, and there has not been one that anybody's been able to come up with that can successfully treat heartworms in cats. So even though they don't get it at the same rate dogs do, dogs in Florida, we see heartworms all the time because it's carried by mosquitoes. And we have tons of mosquitoes here and also tons of dogs that are heartworm positive. And the mosquito carries the heartworm from the infected dog to the uninfected dog. And so any area where you live that has a lot of dogs that have heartworms, your dog's more likely to get heartworms if they're not on prevention because that mosquito is carrying it is a vector from the infected dog to the uninfected dog. And so, so your cat, you know, might luck out a little bit because they don't tend to get it at the same rate as dogs. But the unfortunate thing is if they get it, there isn't anything that we can do.
You're listening to Animal Airwaves Live here on Florida's 89.1 WUFT-FM. This is our weekly hour-long show devoted to the discussion of the health and welfare of animals. I'm Dana Hill, and my guest today from the University of Florida College of Veterinary Medicine is our friend Dr. Wendy Mendizi. And we're talking about the prevention of disaster, that is to say, making sure that your animal doesn't suffer for something that is going to both cost you a lot of money and maybe really adversely affect the life of your pet and possibly even lead to death. We're going to take a short break. We'll be back right after this. Welcome back to Animal Airwaves Live here on WUFT-FM, our weekly hour-long show devoted to the discussion of the health and welfare of animals. I'm Dana Hill, and I'm very happy to have in the studio with me Dr. Wendy Mendizi from the University of Florida College of Veterinary Medicine. And before we took a short break, we were talking about prevention of things like heartworms and how that can really save you a lot of money in the long run and even the life of your pet in the case of cats where this is essentially not really treatable. We were talking a little bit earlier about things like parvo and some other vaccines that can be given to help prevent things like distemper. Let's talk about something else that seems unrelated to all of those, but something that for the most part, Dr. Mendizi, is probably fairly common these days, more common, and I would suspect, than it was maybe a couple generations ago, and that would be spaying and neutering,
right?
This can be something that can prevent problems. We don't think of it as that. We think of it as preventing the problem of pet overpopulation, but
sure.
It can prevent some medical problems.
Oh, absolutely, yes. Yeah. So for dogs that are, for example, female dogs or cats that are intact, there are certain health problems that they can develop that we aren't going to see in our spayed counterparts. And that's going to be things like an infection of the uterus. That's something that we see sometimes in animals that are still intact, and that can be a very expensive and life-threatening thing. They get it's called pyometra, and they actually develop pus in their uterus. And that can range anywhere from, you know, just being something that's a treatable infection to something that's life-threatening and requires emergency surgery. Intact females are also much more prone to developing mammary tumors or breast cancer. If they're spayed, that really, really minimizes that risk. And in intact females, and we see that much more often. And just like in human women, that's something that can metastasize to other organs and be something that's fatal for your pet, or at a minimum require surgery to remove and actually do a mastectomy in that animal. And then in male dogs, of course, we see things like prostate enlargement, which sometimes, just like in human men, sometimes most of the time even it's something called benign prostatic hyperplasia, and it's just from that testosterone being there. But if you have an enlarged prostate on a dog, sometimes the workup to figure out is this cancer or is this just, you know, a benign thing, that can be expensive. Whereas in neutered dogs, that's not something that we see as often. Intact dogs, male dogs have and cats have a greater percentage of things like prostate cancer, obviously testicular cancer, perianal tumors, things like that, other types of cancer too, as well.
I'm willing to make myself an example whenever it can be applicable to the topic at hand. And I will say here that one of my late and missed pets, Bella, was a kitty, and she developed pyometra, not related at all to her eventual demise. She had a pretty good run. She was something north of 17 years old.
Wow.
She was a great kitty. Mm-hmm. And she developed this condition probably when she was about, I don't know, 10 years old or something like that.
Right.
And I recall that we took her to the veterinarian because something seemed amiss. Now, she had never been fixed, so to speak, because she lived with her sister, was the only other cat that she was ever around. They didn't go outside.
Sure.
And so we thought, oh, well, why bother even going to the trouble of getting these animals spayed? But then comes this diagnosis of pyometra. And of course,
right.
We had a surgery that took out her uterus and basically most of her reproductive organs, right?
Yes. Yeah.
And it wasn't. I can't even remember, honestly, how much it was. I'm sure at the time I thought, oh, my gosh. But it was something that saved her life, so
yes.
I didn't even balk at the money. But that said, it can be a disaster if you don't take care of it. So why not just go ahead and get your pet spayed or neutered ahead of time? I mean, what does the spaying and neutering cost these days?
Well, that's going to be very variable because, especially at spay and neuter clinics, there are some low-cost spay and neuter clinics out there where you can get it done very affordably, maybe even for a cat under $100. And then there's, other clinics that, are going to, maybe be a little bit more, maybe even up to maybe $350. Probably not going to be a whole lot more than that for a routine spay. In a cat. And again, a lot of times it varies. For example, in dogs, it's going to, go up on the cost might go up on whether or not they're in heat or, their size, if they're, giant breed dog, that kind of thing. But still, we're looking at under $500 for this procedure and often way under $500. You're usually looking at only a couple hundred dollars for that. And a lot of people are, it's not even the cost that prevents them from doing it. They're afraid to put their animal under anesthesia, which of course is that's a reasonable fear. Of course, there's always risk associated with anesthesia, but we do anesthesia, regularly with very few complications. And so when you weigh the complications, potential complications of anesthesia in a young, healthy animal, which are, really very minimal, to the potential complications of, you know, having a sick animal that needs emergency surgery. So like your kitty, you know, needed an emergency surgery to do, you know, what was basically a spay. But then, of course, you're removing an infected uterus where there's the chance for peritonitis and, you know, the risk associated with that. The risk then are much greater than the risk in a very young, healthy animal.
Yeah. Now, it is understandable to have a bit of a fear about anesthesia for your pet when it does carry with it some, albeit small, risk. But if you don't do any spaying or neutering, you may end up having to have that animal under anesthesia anyway, because if the uterus or reproductive organs have to be removed, that's a procedure that requires anesthesia.
Sure, and much longer anesthesia usually. I mean, your typical spay, especially a cat spay, may only be 10 or 15 minutes. Whereas, you know, if you're going in there and removing an infected uterus and trying not to, you know, spread that infection, and you've got an otherwise sick animal that may not be super stable under anesthesia, then obviously you may be looking at a much longer and definitely more dangerous procedure.
And if we can dispel maybe some other fears for people, spaying and neutering is done probably across the country thousands of times a day, right?
Yes.
By veterinarians who do this for a living.
I mean,
spaying and neutering is kind of a procedure that all veterinarians will be trained on.
Oh, absolutely, yes.
And you do it so often that it is probably one of the procedures that, I don't know, you as a veterinarian probably figure this isn't hard to you anymore. You just kind of go in and you do it quickly, and there's very seldom any kind of complications, and it's done, and the animal seems to recover quite well.
Mm-hmm.
So with the spaying and neutering, it's almost a no-brainer in my mind.
Right.
And in fact, in terms of the cost, I seem to recall that under the circumstances of maybe adopting a pet from a shelter or other sort of organization like a shelter, the spaying and neutering is probably already done anyway.
Almost always it's already done. So that's one thing that happens in the shelter environment. And even in puppies and kittens, because again, these, you know, shelters are trying to get these guys out and adopted. And so, you know, a lot of times their spaying and neutering will be done, you know, young, 10, 12 weeks of age. And so almost every animal that you adopt from the shelter will be already spayed and neutered. So that'll be behind you already, with a very few exceptions of very young animals. And then, of course, the shelter still takes care of the cost of doing that once they're old enough to do it. And so adopting a pet, you know, that's something that's usually already done for you, which is nice. And in fact, depending on the age of the animal, if they're over 4 months of age, then usually all the vaccines have also been given too. So that's one cost that you don't have to worry about when you're obtaining that pet.
So I've told many times on the show a story about adopting Moggy, and I got her when, I don't know, she might have been 9 months old, 10 months old, maybe probably less than a year, but she had already been spayed and she had already gotten some of her vaccines. I did sign a little form saying, yes, I was going to take her to the veterinarian within a certain amount of time, you know, just to make sure that everything was okay. But she didn't require anything at the time that we brought her home. I paid $100 as an adoption fee.
Right.
So that already took care of the spaying and these vaccinations.
Yeah.
It's a supreme bargain for this kitty that gives me all this pleasure.
Yes.
And, you know, that's so fantastic that that can be done that way, and that it's already done means that I don't have to now, at this point, worry about her getting some sort of sickness that would require her to go in and have anesthesia to have her reproductive organs removed.
Right. Not for that. And again, there's lots of different types of surgeries that may be necessary as they get older, things that we can't prevent. And again, we see that, you know, we see that a lot, things that are not going to be preventable. But again, there are so many things in veterinary medicine that are preventable. That, you know, it's good to know what those are.
And let's go further down the list. Okay, so we've talked about spaying and neutering.
Mm-hmm.
What about something like, we many of us are a bit too kind to our animals, and kindness in human society is often expressed via cuisine and food. And so some of us might just give our animals treats right and left, or table food from our own meals. Keeping your pet trim is a kind of way of preventing the slow disaster of unhealthy obesity?
Yeah, we see so many problems that are caused by obesity. Again, it sort of parallels, you know, what goes on in humans. We see so many problems. One of the major orthopedic problems that we see in especially larger breed dogs is going to be a cranial cruciate ligament rupture, or ACL in humans. It's a very, very common injury. We see it usually at least once a week, sometimes more than that. And it's something that is the largest largest demographic is going to be, of course, large breed dogs, but overweight large breed dogs. And so, you know, I have you know, two dogs, and both dogs have ruptured both cruciate ligaments, believe it or not. And one dog was not at all overweight. She was only a year old, and it was traumatic, and she was, you know, running around the yard. And so, you know, sometimes you're not going to be able to prevent that. It's just going to be something that happens. But, you know, my other dog was, you know, pretty chunky, and she was pretty overweight, and ruptured both of hers. And so it's a very expensive surgery to, you know, we're talking about probably about $2,500 or more dollars, to, you know, for that surgery. And so, you know, again, you're not always going to be able to prevent that, but it is something that that by keeping your dog trim, you may decrease the chances of that happening. So the other thing that we can see when it comes to cats is we do see a lot of obese cats, and cats are very, very prone to actually the same thing that overweight humans are, which is type 2 diabetes. And so that's something, you know, again, this is, you know, not an inexpensive disease to treat, just because they require regular blood glucose monitorings and blood glucose curves that are in the hospital, regular blood work. And then if they actually get into trouble with their diabetes and can develop a condition called DKA or diabetic ketoacidosis, that's something that you know, can be life-threatening and require hospitalization that may be to the tune of, you know, a few thousand dollars. And so that is, you know, one of those things that's almost exclusively in cats seen in obese cats. And so it's extremely preventable.
And diabetes is not reversible?
Some cats, if detected early enough and their diet is changed and we're able to institute a weight loss plan in usually in conjunction with starting them on some insulin, you know, in very few cases you can actually get diabetic remission. But it's actually not something that we even tell owners to expect, because most of the time when we start treating a cat for their diabetes, they're going to require twice daily insulin injections almost always for the rest of their life.
Okay. So we've got the cruciate ligament rupture.
Mm-hmm.
What's that going to cost a dog owner?
Well, again, this you know, depends on whether the owner pursues surgery or not. Surgery is going to be the gold standard of treatment, you know, to prevent, you know, lifelong arthritis and lameness in those knees. And so, you know, the surgery, again, depending on where it's performed and what type of surgery is done, can range anywhere from, you know, maybe, you know, $1,200 to $1,500 to $100,000 to $3,000 per knee.
Okay, so you cannot prevent your dog from perhaps experiencing a trauma that causes this condition. I mean,
right.
Dogs love to go out and run and
sure.
play.
Yeah.
But if you know that your dog is substantially overweight,
mm-hmm.
then you could be doing something that mm-hmm. actually is less expensive, and that is not feeding your dog as much.
Right, right.
And then that might prevent this dog from having this condition that could be
sure.
painful and expensive.
Right, exactly. And you know, I was talking specifically about something like cruciate ligament rupture, but really, in reality, you know, any orthopedic disease that a dog has, again, just like with us, you know, we feel a lot better when we, you know, aren't carrying as much weight, both, you know, joint-wise especially. And that's going to be true of dogs too. Say if they have underlying hip dysplasia, if it's a breed that, you know, is known to have hip dysplasia, or if it's a dog that has hip dysplasia, that keeping that dog trim is going to really add a lot of longevity and comfort to that dog. You know, so really any joint disease. Another really, really good example is, you know, what we call our long and low breeds. So that's going to be Basset Hounds and Dachshunds. They are very – just their conformation predisposes them to having intervertebral disc disease, or what, you know, we call a slip disc. In a dog, especially, again, because of their conformation, that's something that, you know, you can, you know, wake up one morning and your dog's unable to move his back legs. And we're talking about a really expensive surgery to go in and do spinal surgery and decompress these discs. We're talking about $3,000 to $4,000, which is usually cost preventative for a lot of people. And again, without treatment, can lead to the euthanasia or the death of that dog. And that's something that, you know, the number one predisposing factor, again, there's nothing we can do about their conformation, but them being overweight is the number one thing that predisposes them to this happening.
So that would be an expensive fix. Diabetes could be a lifelong expense that will go on for as long as this animal lives to
usually.
Kind of make sure that it's up to speed with its insulin or whatever it's
right.
going to need. But keeping your pet trim, again, is a pretty cost-effective thing to do. But mm-hmm. I wonder if... I could see myself even doing this, and I know I have a very dear friend and I love her so much, but I remember saying to her once when I saw her cat, Stella is way too fat. This cat is enormous. She says, no, she's just furry. She's just furry. I said, I don't know. It hurts me when she's on my lap. I think Stella needs to lose some weight. And so fast forward a few years, and I see Stella again, and Stella looks great. She's she's lost quite a bit of weight, and that puts her in a much better place health-wise, at least reducing the risk of some of these diseases that might be weight-related.
Absolutely, yeah, and good for your friend for getting that weight off, because it's, you know, just like with us, it's a lot harder to get it off than it is to prevent it from, you know, showing up in the first place.
And sure, and it happens because, of course, our animals are adorable, and they smell our food, and we want to give them some.
Sure.
Or maybe we just leave the food bowl out, and some animals can't control their propensity to eating nearly as much. They just don't have kind of that self-control.
Right.
And then there you go. You're putting on weight. And when we talk about weight gain in an animal, when you're talking about a cat that should probably only be, what, about 10 pounds or so, right?
I mean, there's different – I mean, it all depends on the frame of the cat. Mm-hmm. We have certain, you know, just sort of guidelines that we use to tell if an animal's overweight. That's not just, you know, straight weight. You know, do they have a nice tucked-in waist? Can you easily feel their ribs? You know, that kind of thing. So it's really more of, you know, kind of looking at them to decide. Because, for example, a Maine Coon cat, which are, you know, they're very big cats, normal for that cat maybe 15 pounds, whereas for, you know, for your kitty, like Moggy, 15 pounds, you should be a butterball.
sure. And so there we get to kind of another thing. And, you know, you can't probably get your cat to sit on a scale or whatever, but you can kind of do yourself that little exam. And for your dog or your cat, that might mean just kind of like feeling around. And what are you feeling around for? You're feeling around for the ribs.
Right. So, and you know, that's something that I think is really important. And when we work with students at the university, I have this discussion with every, you know, puppy or kitten, because that's the time to talk about these kind of things, to show an owner, because, you know, a lot of times they just they don't even know their pet is overweight. And then you show them, you know, with a picture what a normal dog body conformation is, and they think, oh my gosh, you know, I had no idea. You know, so dogs shouldn't look like a column. You should see a nice deep chest and a nice tucked in waist. And some people see that conformation and think their dog's too thin, but in reality, that's normal conformation. If they look more like a, you know, cylinder or more of a column, it's usually because they're a little bit on the overweight side. You should easily be able to feel the ribs and not have a lot of extra padding over the rib cage. You don't want to see the ribs from across the room, but, you know, you want to be able to easily feel those. If you have a little extra padding there, then that's, you know, going to probably mean your pet may be a little overweight. And so I like to talk about those things with owners before their pet is overweight and talk about ways to prevent it from happening. So, you know, try to avoid commercial treats if possible. Maybe use frozen green beans or other little pieces of veggies as treats instead if you need to give them at all. A nice, well-balanced dog food without a lot of extra, you know, table food or treats, and then lots of exercise. And so I think if you talk about that, their first visit when they're a puppy, before it turns into a problem, you know, that's what preventative care is all about, is preventing it from happening. Because as we all know, it's harder to get those extra pounds off than it is to prevent them from getting there in the first place.
Now, we only have about 4 minutes left, and I don't want to give this topic short shrift, and that is care of the teeth, because tooth problems can be costly.
Absolutely. And so, again, we can go back to the anesthesia issue a little bit. I mean, sometimes we'll recommend a prophy, and we really recommend a dental prophy whenever that dog or cat has gingivitis. And so that's going to be that inflamed red line kind of right where the gum meets the tooth. And once that's inflamed, then we know there's some periodontal disease going on, and we definitely want to go ahead and clean that dog or cat's teeth. And a lot of people, again, because it is something that has to be done under general anesthesia, and a lot of people are afraid of that, which is, again, completely understandable. But we're talking about a really pretty quick procedure to go ahead and do that. And again, in otherwise healthy animals, that absolutely should be fine. But what happens a lot of times is that's just put off and put off and put off. And then what we see is dogs that need multiple extractions because their periodontal disease has gotten so bad that many, many teeth need to be removed. Some are abscessed. Some have abscessed to the point that the jaw is broken or that infection has eaten into the sinus cavity. We see that regularly. I wish I could say it was something – it was just every once in a while. It's not. It's every week, you know, on our service. And so and again, now we're talking about a procedure that may be 4 hours, you know, 3-4 hours, and, you know, $1,500 or, you know, again, I'm ballparking. But, you know, so we went from, you know, whereas just regular and even if you're not needing to do regular dental cleanings under anesthesia, just if you brush your pet's teeth at home, if you start that when they're young and go ahead and start brushing those teeth, and we do recommend doing it daily with a dog-approved or cat-approved toothpaste, a veterinary-approved toothpaste, then you may even prevent them from needing to go – you may prevent that gingivitis from ever even forming and them from even needing to go under anesthesia. And that's not going to cost you anything really other than the cost of the toothbrush and toothpaste.
And an extraction or a series of extractions may cost you north of $1,000. But
yes.
Let's also think about something that it's hard to put a price on, and that is that your pet could be very uncomfortable.
Absolutely. A lot of times these guys are really uncomfortable, and I'm always amazed at you know, sometimes, you know, as owners, you know, we'll think that, oh, you know, our pet's just slowing down. They're, you know, 10, 12 years old, and they're just kind of slowing down. And then we, you know, do a dentistry, and we remove all of these really infected, diseased teeth. And then the owner says, oh, my gosh, my dog is like a puppy again, or my cat is playing, you know, now. And you know, what we thought of was just kind of slowing down was actually just oral discomfort from these really diseased teeth. So a lot of times we think it's just, you know, kind of, you know, stinky breath. But really it's way more than that. And in fact, that infection that's in the mouth can even get under that inflamed gum line and go to the kidneys or to the heart and actually create life-threatening disease.
And last but not least, something that really doesn't cost you anything at all to take care of that will perhaps prevent a major disaster, and that is keep your dog on a leash when mm-hmm. you're out walking.
Mm-hmm.
Don't let your animals wander too far away from home
right.
because getting hit by a car mm-hmm. or getting attacked by another animal can be either fatal
mm-hmm.
or certainly require a great deal of surgery that is painful, takes a long time to recover from maybe, and is very expensive.
Right, yeah. So, I mean, we obviously that's something that we, you know, see quite a bit of, dogs that are hit by cars, cats that are hit by cars or are in fights or attacked by other animals. And, you know, this could, you know, range from anything from a few puncture wounds that, you know, you just kind of clean up and you know, is not super expensive to something that, you know, either could be fatal or require thousands of dollars worth of therapy. And so, you know, yeah, definitely, just like you said, keeping your pet on a leash, making sure that they're secured in a yard if they're, you know, staying in a yard and aren't able to get out. And those things are really, really important.
Well, Dr. Wendy Mendizi from the UF College of Veterinary Medicine, thank you so much for coming back and talking to us today. I really enjoyed it.
Thank you for having me.
I want to say thank you to Sarah Carey over at the Vet School. I am Dana Hill, and I want to tell you all that you've been listening to Animal Airwaves Live here on Florida's 89.1 WUFT-FM. We'll be back next week with another Animal Airwaves Live. Bye-bye.